Word of mouth.
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 Well, definitely.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, a centrist manifesto. A Dartmouth professor thinks through an alternative to our unpopular and unproductive Congress and advocates for a third party that empowers the middle. Plus, cartoonist Tom Gauld on telling funny stories in small spaces. But first, a DNA dragnet. In February, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Maryland v. King concerning the warrantless collection of DNA from people arrested for, but not convicted of, a crime. The case against the state questions whether DNA collected from people still presumed innocent violates the Fourth Amendment. The decision would have far-reaching implications in the real world, where DNA solves far fewer crimes than on TV. Jason Silverstein is a PhD student in anthropology at Harvard and a contributor to The Nation. He looked into the racial implications of the case that Justice Samuel Alito called perhaps the most important criminal procedure case that this court has heard in decades. And Jason Silverstein, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Fill us in on this case. Beginning on April 10th, 2009, when Alonzo King was arrested on assault charges. What happened?
Well, he was originally arrested on these charges of assault. I think he was waving a shotgun at some people. And when he was in custody, the police took a DNA sample from him. This is basically the best type of case that you could get, because that DNA sample was found to match evidence that from an unsolved rape that had happened about, I think, 6 years prior. That ultimately led to King's conviction of the crime, and it solved this case. So this was a great example of when you can identify the guilty, and I'm sure we've heard about the Innocence Project exonerating innocent people, mm-hmm. but there was this appeal, and they said, well, look, you know, is there this constitutional question that arrestees have this privacy expectation? After all, someone who's arrested is presumed innocent and therefore really is no different than you or I. The second point here was that there was no warrant to do this. So this could potentially now say that the state could investigate you without a warrant, without suspicion, just to sort of see what's there.
So the case that King's legal team made to the court was that arrestees have privacy expectations that outweigh the state's crime-solving interest. The Maryland Court of Appeals determined in his favor. Now, how does the state of Maryland then, which we should point out is one of 28 states and federal law enforcement that collects DNA upon arrest, how does the state respond?
Well, the state's response was interesting because, you know, they would say, well, look, we do have an interest in solving crime, and that DNA is basically like the 21st century version of fingerprints. They would also suggest now that as DNA technology becomes better and quicker and faster to return results, this could also be something that you'd want in a bail determination, because someone who's arrested, you want to know how dangerous that person is. Now, when they argued that before the Supreme Court, of course, Justice Roberts just responded that, well, we have to decide the case today and not in the future. But that would be their best argument. Now, of course, King's side pushes back on that, but that's what Maryland would say to you.
All right. So once in CODIS, this is the Combined DNA Index System. This is a national database. Your data is stored. How effective has this DNA collection been in solving crimes in the past?
Well, you know, there are cases like this one with King, where it was successful, and there are some other, I think, high-profile cases where it was used to catch a serial killer, for example. But the fact of the matter is that it catches far fewer criminals. In 2011, Maryland police had collected nearly 11,000 DNA samples. Only 19 of those led to an arrest, and only 9 of those led to a conviction. I think one thing that should be pointed out is that often people who are arrested for a felony sometimes are just never even actually charged for a crime. So in California, for instance, that was 56,000 people in 2011. Now, each one of them would have had to have submitted a DNA sample, but they were never even actually brought up on charges. So I think that's important to keep in mind. Some people don't even get to a trial, and that actually makes it very hard to get out of that system if you're never actually tried for a crime that you've been arrested of.
We're talking about Marilyn V. King and warrantless DNA collection with Jason Silverstein. He's a PhD student at Harvard. He's also a contributor to The Nation, where he wrote about the case. And Jason, your research, the article you wrote in The Nation, focuses on the dark side of DNA. Now, that's quite an ominous headline, but your concern is that these procedures disproportionately affect people of color. How so?
Well, here's how it ends up working. If you have a system where you're already going to disproportionately be stopping and searching and arresting people of color, and if you start collecting DNA from them, then you're essentially going to have a disproportionate representation in that database. And that's what we've already seen. Currently, in the federal database, about 40% of the entire system is African-American DNA. Now, DNA, as opposed to a fingerprint, is a little different, right? DNA, you can use that to identify people's families. And some states are doing this, actually, and they're doing this familial searching, which then opens up entire families and then communities and really an entire race of people into what Howard University called a sort of probable cause generator. Because now if you pop up on a potential suspect list, now you're open to other forms of police investigation. So that's why it seems like this actually ends up creating this sort of racial dragnet, because this is being introduced into a biased police system.
But what if that DNA evidence that's in this system, albeit biased, leads to conviction of crimes? Can't the case be made that this is its purpose?
Sure. I think that any time you're going to have a Fourth Amendment case, you're going to have two sides that are basically arguing privacy versus security. And in fact, our most conservative justice on the court, Justice Scalia, basically responded within the first couple of minutes of oral arguments, look, if you conduct a lot of unreasonable searches and seizures, you're definitely going to get more convictions. So I would concede that if you were to put everyone's DNA in a database, you probably would solve more crimes. The question would be whether or not that would be constitutional or whether it would be fair. I think my position that I would take is that this is effectively is not going to be a fair system, because you're going to open up disproportionately one group and one community to more and more policing. So, yeah, I think that outweighs the interest of solving some crimes for me, how it would create this racial dragnet.
Expect decision on Marilyn V. King before the summer, so we will know then. And Jason Silverstein, PhD student in anthropology at Harvard, he wrote an article called The Dark Side of DNA for The Nation. Thank you so much for joining us, Jason.
Thank you.
There's a link to read the article for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. And stay with us for a slow-moving species in rapid decline. We'll meet a crusader for the wood turtle when Word of Mouth continues.